Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Deadly Don, Vito Genovese, Mafia Boss, by Anthony M. DeStefano, narrated by Danny Campbell. Introduction. In his masterful World War II black comedy Catch-22, novelist Joseph Heller described a scene involving the naive bomber pilot Lieutenant Neatley, we never know his first name in the story, and a lecherous old man in a brothel in wartime Rome, Italy. Neatley, ever the image of the profoundly confident American soldier, couldn't seem to understand the old man who spent his days leering at the scantily clad buxom whores, sipping wine, and living what seemed to be an unprincipled philosophy of life. What really seemed to incense Neatley was the way the old man, he was never given a name in the novel, was so unprincipled and supported whichever army or dictator was on top at the moment. Italy would actually win the way by losing it, the old man crowed. You talk like a madman, scoffed Neatley. But I live like a sane one, the old man replied. I was a fascist when Mussolini was on top, and I am an anti-fascist now that he was deposed. I was fanatically pro-German when the Germans were here to protect us against the Americans, and now that the Americans are here to protect us against the Germans, I am fanatically pro-American. But you're a turncoat, exclaimed Neatley, a time-server, a shameful, unscrupulous opportunist. Well, that may have been, but the old man reminded Neatley that he was 107 years old. The fresh-faced young American, only 19, wouldn't, in the novel, live beyond his 20th birthday. The old man's philosophy for survival in the war, by gauging the way the prevailing political winds blew and backing whomever was on top at the moment, serves as a metaphor for the way Vito Anthony Genovese, mafia boss, even with an IQ measured below 100, used his street smarts to negotiate the treacherous path of life in La Cosa Nostra. With the equivalent of a third-grade education and from an Italian family background of very modest means, Genovese developed into what one federal official said was a suave, shrewd, cruel, calculating, cunning, ruthless individual. It was a mix of the right traits to rise in the world of organized crime. The steely-eyed Genovese combined these traits with brutality and bided his time in the deadly world of organized crime to become one of the most important figures in the history of the mob in America during what was its golden period. From the time he emigrated to the United States in 1913 on a steamship and decided on a life of crime, the Neapolitan-bred Genovese developed a keen sense of which of the key figures in the early days of the New York City mob it was best to align with. With killing after killing, Genovese proved his worth to those who held the power. When the mob was raking in millions of dollars with the advent of Prohibition, Genovese proved his loyalty and earned a reputation for making his own fortune. Then, when things became too dangerous for him with the cops in New York, Genovese fled to Italy in the years before World War II, ingratiating himself with Italian dictator Benito Mussolini's clique and with the Germans. When the defeat of the Axis became inevitable, Genovese craftily shifted his allegiance to the U.S. military, all the while continuing to run a lucrative criminal empire in the wartime black market. His instincts for survival were right out of the script of the old man in Catch-22. Once called the King of the Rackets by legendary prosecutor Thomas Dewey, Genovese survived the mob wars of Prohibition by aligning himself first with Joseph Masseria, considered one of the first significant Italian organized crime bosses in America, and then Charles Lucky Luciano, the man who led the coup that carried dispatched Masseria to a mausoleum in Calvary Cemetery. It was a murder that some claim involved Genovese as one of the triggermen, or at least his presence at the crime scene. The homicide wouldn't be the last to figure in Genovese's life. As his reward for helping take out Masseria, Genovese became a key member of Luciano's crime family, one of the five mafia clans that emerged in the realignment of the mob in New York City, orchestrated by Luciano after Masseria was blown away. By all accounts, Genovese acquitted himself well. He seemed to have become wealthy in both his legitimate and illegitimate enterprises, and was considered by Luciano to be a major part of the family. With his early loyalty to boss Luciano, Genovese showed a certain adeptness in mob politics, and thrived in a world where death at the hands of your friends was an all-too-common occurrence. Genovese wormed his way out of numerous arrests and one assassination attempt, and was never convicted in this period of anything significant. So long as Genovese didn't screw up, he would be fine. When Luciano was sent away to prison for up to 50 years in 1936 in a prostitution case, Genovese was one of the top men in the crime family to help run things in the boss's absence. But the overall acting leader tapped by Luciano was Frank Costello, the mobster diplomat whose entrenchment with the Democratic Party, conciliatory manner, and legitimate business interests made him a first among equals in the family. Passed over by Luciano, Genovese would harbor a deep, lifelong resentment towards Costello. Genovese was no match for Costello's combination of political power and money-making ability. Costello recognized the benefits of cutting people in for a share of the rackets, although he was not above screwing his partners. So long as Costello was around, Genovese had a sense of inferiority. In the late 1930s, Genovese was really not in a position to move against Costello, who had numerous mobsters in his corner. In any case, even if Genovese wanted to make a power play, he suddenly found himself in trouble. An old murder rap in Brooklyn, stemming from a debt in a card game, compelled Genovese in early 1937 to flee to Italy. He had wisely scouted out Europe during an ostensible vacation to the continent in 1933, so he knew the lay of the land and likely explored some offshore banking havens. Taking with him a reported $750,000 in cash, Genovese settled back in Italy, leaving his wife Anna to take care of the three children and to fend for herself in a mansion in New Jersey. Genovese knew that staying on Mussolini's good side would definitely assure his safety, and he did so by giving money that helped the fascist party and by befriending Il Duce's son-in-law, Count Galeazzo Ciano, with whom he partied and allegedly supplied narcotics. When anti-fascist editor Carlo Tresca was gunned down on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan on January 11, 1943, some investigators believed it was Genovese who arranged for mob killers in New York to do the deed as a favor to his protectors in Rome, a theory that is open to some doubt, as will be discussed within. There were reports that Genovese curried favor with the German military, which in July 1943 had occupied Italy, and that he had served as an intelligence source for the Nazis, although that has never been substantiated. Anna would relate during court testimony that Genovese would party with the likes of Hermann Göring. In any case, Genovese had no worries with the Axis powers. When the Allied forces invaded Sicily in 1943 as part of Operation Husky, the German and Italian forces were defeated in about a month. Some say that in Sicily the U.S. Army came of age, and soon, as Patton had predicted, it pushed on to Messina and the toe of the Italian peninsula. The Allies then engineered an amphibious landing near Salerno in September 1943, and the battle was joined on the Italian mainland, although the inexperience of the American commander, General Mark Clark, almost caused the landing to be withdrawn in defeat. With continuing reversals, Genovese's ally Mussolini was soon arrested and would later be murdered by partisans. As the Germans were pushed further northward, the Allies formed the AMGOT, short for the Allied Military Government of Occupied Territories, and sensing a new opportunity for survival, Genovese offered his services to the new masters in Italy as a translator. The offer was accepted, and the crafty Genovese lived to thrive among the Allies, along with his lucrative black market operations, which he ran right under the noses of the American, British, and Canadian forces. Eventually, thanks to an inquisitive American military policeman with the strange name of Orange Dickey, Genovese's life as a criminal and his open murder warrant were discovered. It took a year of legal and military wrangling, but Genovese was brought back under military escort on the SS James Likes to stand trial for the Brooklyn homicide. But even under the thumb of prosecutors in Brooklyn, Genovese's luck, or his insidious ability to corrupt the criminal justice system, worked to save him. Peter LaTempa, who prosecutors thought would seal the case against Genovese for the murder of Ferdinand Boccia, died in a jail cell after taking an overdose of gastric medicine. Other potential witnesses either wound up murdered, disappeared, or in the case of co-defendants, legally couldn't testify under the legal rules because they were co-conspirators in the crime. The case went all the way to jury selection, but at the prosecutor's request, Judge Samuel Leibowitz reluctantly ruled that the case had to be dismissed over lack of evidence, but not before he blasted Genovese for escaping the clutches of the law again. "You are always one step ahead of Sing Sing and the electric chair," said Leibowitz, after he was forced to order an acquittal in the case. "I believe that even if there was a shred of corroborating evidence, you would have been condemned to the chair." If Genovese could be smug with the acquittal in the murder case, his personal life was entering a phase that would lead to bigger problems. Anna Genovese, an attractive woman born in New York of Italian immigrant parents and distantly related to her husband, had accompanied him on his earlier trip back to Italy. There is also some evidence that she accompanied him for a time when he fled to Italy during the Mussolini years. For a while, anyway, Anna, who was Genovese's second wife, was the jewel in his existence, raising three children and working the nightclub scene in Greenwich Village, where he had secret interests. But their marriage would, in the years ahead, become a disaster for Genovese. At one point, he claimed she sold some of his business interests right from under him after she traveled to Italy in 1939 and he gave her power of attorney over his American businesses. Then, in a highly publicized marital action which commenced in 1950, Anna gave damning court testimony in which she proclaimed he was raking in tens of thousands of dollars in illegal activities, from the Italian lottery to labor shakedowns, and parking the cash in banks as far away as Switzerland and Monte Carlo. Anna portrayed her husband as a physically abusive man who also spent time chasing other women, an irony in that it would later be said that she was bisexual and had other lovers, male and female. Whatever the truth of Anna's claims, which she made as the case dragged on, the sensational headlines hurt Genovese's standing in the mob. His personal life became something of a soap opera that others in the mafia never had to endure. The bad press and notoriety came at a time when the public had already been captivated by revelations about the mob from the 1951 U.S. congressional hearings chaired by Senator Estes Kefauver. The allegations in L'Affaire Genovese only further fueled interest in salacious gossip about the mafia. Anna later dropped her divorce action, but lived apart from her husband after winning a monthly award for financial support. While his marriage was hopelessly shattered, Genovese nevertheless stayed a step ahead of the law. In the 1951 congressional hearings, Genovese earned only a handful of mentions in the testimony. Instead, the Senate turned its attention to Costello, who agreed to testify before Kefauver's committee. Costello's appearance turned out to be a disaster. While he believed he had nothing to hide, Costello came across as shifty, evasive, and untruthful. His raspy voice made him sound like a stereotypical gangster. What's more, while the public saw only his hands on the television broadcasts of the hearings, Costello's guilty conscience about something seemed to come across as his fingers fidgeted and he rubbed his sweaty palms. Costello's Kefauver committee appearance not only hurt him with the public, but also made him vulnerable in the world of organized crime. His demeanor had been that of a wounded man, and Costello found himself not only having to do damage control in public, but also bracing for the wrath of federal investigators. Convicted of obstructing and lying to Congress, Costello was sent away for 18 months in prison in 1952, thus making Genovese the top acting boss on the street for the old Luciano family. Genovese, although himself hurt by the public accusations his wife had been making against him, still managed to fend off prosecutors. Public hearings into labor racketeering and dockland corruption burnished Genovese's image as a major crime boss in New York City. But still, he seemed to elude the law, even as he met with criminal associates openly on Kenmare Street in Little Italy. Genovese also took out troublesome crime family members like Willie Moretti and Peter Franze, who was rumored to have bedded Anna while her husband was abroad during World War II. Then, in May 1957, Genovese went after Costello and set in motion the attempted assassination as Costello entered the lobby of his apartment building on Central Park West after a night out with friends. The shooting of Costello only grazed his head, and the old crime boss fully recovered. But Costello got the message, and in a truce with Genovese, he agreed to retire from the mob, leaving leadership of the family in Genovese's hands. But history would show that Genovese's reign as the boss would run into trouble almost immediately. In November, some 6 months after the attempt on the life of Costello, Genovese and scores of other mob bosses were detained after they all assembled at the Apalachin, New York home of mobster Joseph Barbara. The conclave was ostensibly an opportunity for the gangsters to show some respect for the sickly Barbara and share some good food. But Mafia turncoat Joseph Valachi later revealed that Genovese had called everyone together to anoint him as boss of the family. Other business at the summit was said to have included the murder 2 months earlier of crime boss Albert Anastasia and what the American mob should do about the lucrative and dangerous narcotics trade. But the meeting broke up as the cops became suspicious of the gathering. Genovese and many of the other mafia bosses would then spend over 2 years fighting legal proceedings over the meeting after federal officials claimed the barbecue was nothing more than a cover for a nefarious conspiratorial meeting of mob bosses. Ultimately, Genovese wouldn't be indicted over Apalachin, and others who were charged would see their convictions thrown out by an appeals court. But the damage had been done. If Genovese had engineered the summit as a sort of coronation for himself, as Valachi said, it had backfired badly, causing major trouble between himself and the other mafiosi. Genovese also made a major miscalculation over narcotics, something the mob ostensibly had a ban against, but which unfortunately had turned into a big moneymaker for a number of mafiosi. Federal investigators with the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, FBN, the forerunner of the Drug Enforcement Administration, were well aware of the mafia's involvement with narcotics, mainly heroin, and had targeted hundreds of its members in various investigations. The biggest catch would turn out to be Genovese, who was arrested in July 1958, along with nearly three dozen others, on charges they were part of a major global heroin smuggling ring. For federal prosecutors in Manhattan, Genovese was the right man, sitting at the top of a trafficking network between Europe, the Caribbean, and the United States. Some legal experts would insist that Genovese was framed, that somebody of his stature in the mob wouldn't dirty his hands with involvement in drugs, at least not directly. The idea is plausible, but the evidence against Genovese, while circumstantial and based largely on the testimony of one witness, was enough to convict him in April 1959. The resulting sentence garnered Genovese a term of 15 years in a federal penitentiary. While incarcerated, Genovese still ran the crime family that came to bear his name. But as time went on, Genovese found it more difficult to control things, and the mafiosi back in New York planned for his succession. Then, in a major development that shook the mafia to the core, and in which Genovese appeared to be a catalyst, his old associate, Valachi, a killer from the Bronx who never really got that high up in the mob hierarchy, but could talk up a storm nonetheless, turned into a government witness. It was Valachi who in 1963 broke the fabled mafia code of silence, Omerta, and held the nation entranced as he detailed in public hearings before Congress the secrets of La Cosa Nostra, as Italian organized crime was known on the inside. Valachi had been a close associate of Genovese and portrayed him as the key figure in the mob, a man who ordered multiple murders and commanded a criminal empire, in much the way Anna Genovese had said. Valachi's testimony and the secrets he revealed in confidential debriefings provided fodder for law enforcement agencies all over the country, although in the end there was only one significant prosecution that resulted, that involving Carmine Persico. Even Genovese, already spending his old age in prison, remained unscathed by Valachi's stories. But Valachi did a different kind of damage to Genovese. The mob knew that Valachi had been part of Genovese's Borgata, his mafia family, and his turning into a government witness only added to the sullied reputation Don Vito had suffered. Valachi added more salt to Genovese's wounds when he penned a best-selling book with author Peter Moss called The Valachi Papers. If the mob hadn't watched Valachi on television, his book gave them the whole story, never missing a chance to mention Genovese's name. Plagued by heart disease and other ailments, including cancer, Genovese steadily slipped into infirmity, spending his prison days going to Catholic services, reading, and hoping for a legal miracle that would get him out of prison. On February 14, 1969, decades of smoking and not taking care of himself caught up with Genovese. He died from complications of a heart ailment in the federal prison hospital in Springfield, Missouri. He was 71 years old, and as he had waited the approach of his scheduled release date, Genovese had busied himself with his Catholic faith, studying the religion in his cell and helping the prison chaplain with services. Despite all the misfortune and bad luck Genovese faced with his life within La Cosa Nostra, he was one of the few bosses who was important enough to become the namesake of a crime family. Today in New York City, the Genovese family and the Gambino family still have most of whatever mafia clout remains. The other three groups, the Lucchese, Bonanno, and Colombo families, have been more severely hurt by prosecutions, turncoats, and competition from other ethnic crime groups. While other mob bosses have been the subjects of recent biographical treatments, Genovese has not. The one exception is the 1959 book by the old Journal American reporter Dom Frasca, who along with his editor wrote King of Crime, a book long out of print and now going for close to $1,000 on the internet. Frasca's book was the state of the art for the time, written as it was before Genovese was convicted in the heroin case. The tone of King of Crime was sympathetic, and Frasca apparently enjoyed some special access to Genovese, likely because his relative may have been Cosmo Gus Frasca, an associate of the crime boss, and would be a figure in a major homicide case. If for nothing else, King of Crime contains some remarkable candid photos of Genovese in domestic scenes, cooking pasta, doing yard work, and lounging around his Atlantic Highlands house as he lived the life of a bachelor. Estranged wife Anna was living elsewhere. The images portray a grandfatherly Genovese in his dotage. Frasca interviewed Genovese in the company of his lawyer at the mobster's home and got some terrific quotes, even if the crime boss said nothing incriminating. Frasca was no slouch as a reporter, winning accolades from government officials for his work. But some of the material in King of Crime is suspect. For a start, there are facts and dates recited by Frasca that are incorrect. But the big issue is that Frasca quotes long conversations Genovese had over the years with others, with no indication of how authentic the quotes are or what the sources may have been. At one point, Frasca portrays a conversation Genovese had with his parents, both of whom were dead by the 1930s, long before the book was written. One federal judge who reviewed a feature story Frasca did about Genovese for a magazine wrote in a ruling that the writer's account contained highly fictionalized versions of actual events that took place in court, with some journalistic embellishments. If Frasca made up quotes, he wouldn't have been the first true crime writer to have done so. Still, while realizing that there are problems with King of Crime, the book is useful as a source since much of the factual material, dates, places, courts, is correct. Where King of Crime is cited in The Deadly Dawn, I give it proper cautions so that readers can make up their minds about accepting the material as credible or not. Bits and pieces of stories about Genovese and his life have appeared in biographies of other gangsters, and he has been the subject of an occasional television documentary. Very little film footage exists of him, and his voice is only preserved for posterity in a few short newsreel clips, notably around the time of the 1958 Senate hearings regarding organized crime. But since Genovese was such a historical figure in the world of crime, and since the passage of time has provided access to additional historical material about him, the idea for the Deadly Don, Vito Genovese, mafia boss, was spawned. Like any key figure in La Cosa Nostra, Genovese had been the subject of a few legends and fables. For instance, he was said to have arranged the murder of Anna's first husband, a lowly thug and burglar named Gerardo Vernatico, so that he could clear the field and marry her. But my research for the Deadly Don indicates that the story of spousal murder is very likely false. Vernatico was already divorced from Anna when a group of thugs, with no known connection to Genovese, strangled him. Anna, it seems, was already pregnant and gave birth 3 months after she and Genovese tied the knot. Genovese has also been described as the man who engineered the brazen assassination in 1943 of journalist Carlo Tresca on a Manhattan street as a favor to Mussolini. But given the way Italian history was evolving at that point, Mussolini was on the run and had bigger problems to contend with. It is unlikely that he needed the help of Genovese or anyone else to take out Tresca. The real threat may have come from other mobsters in New York whom Tresca had angered. As noted earlier, some insist that Genovese was framed in the big 1959 drug trial. But the evidence, although very circumstantial and without the benefits of wiretaps or other recordings, showed to an appeals court that Genovese portrayed a role in organizing the syndicate. This is not to say the case didn't have some strange elements. A federal agent showed up at Genovese's home during the drug trial and told him that the government was only going after him for publicity. Then the key government witness, a fellow named Nelson Silva Cantalopes, recanted his testimony during a meeting with defense attorneys and a Catholic priest, only to later disavow his recantation. Cantalopes would be beaten up in prison and might have suffered worse if it wasn't for Governor Nelson Rockefeller pardoning him. But Cantalopes couldn't stay out of trouble, dying in a knife fight in a Bronx bar in July 1965. As I have done with my other mafia books, the approach for The Deadly Don was to immerse myself into the life of Genovese. This required a great deal of paper chasing through court files, both federal and state. Genovese's criminal record until the big 1959 trial involved a series of arrests and indictments in the 1920s and 1930s, including offenses ranging from weapons possession to counterfeiting and murder. Searching for those records was a challenge, but thanks to the help of some persistent court clerks and researchers at the National Archives and Records Administration, I was steered in the right direction. The result was a mass of documentation, some never before made available, that helped flesh out the story of Genovese in The Deadly Don. There are several important research finds that allowed The Deadly Don to advance the story on Genovese and reveal new information. Perhaps one of the most important finds was the discovery of declassified papers on Genovese in the National Archives that revealed the story of his life and death behind bars. Another unique find was a private deposition Genovese gave in September 1954, when the U.S. government began proceedings to strip him of his American citizenship, which he had been granted in 1935. Within the pages of the transcript, Genovese talked about his early life and various arrests, giving his version of events and trying to make himself look like the aggrieved party. While the deposition didn't reveal the details of Genovese's various arrests, when it was coupled with newspaper articles of the time, a more complete picture emerged. The deposition, along with Genovese's court testimony in the denaturalization trial, helped trace his family life, both before and after the tempestuous Anna came on the scene. The New York City Municipal Archives also helped fill in the mundane facts of Genovese's life, including his first marriage to Donata, a tragic figure who died from tuberculosis at the age of 28. Donata Genovese had a daughter with Genovese named Nancy, but in a twist, state court records hint at a little drama in the family, showing that Donata had a child with another man, a little girl named Lucy, whose story seems lost to history. One person interviewed for this book suggested that the way Genovese cared for Donata while she was ill indicated...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?